You are listening to Type Radio. My name is Brian Lucent. Now we're talking.
Type Radio FM.
Now we're talking.
We saw your presentation just now, and what struck me is that, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of these new developments, especially in interactive design, is that it starts with a game. Like they choose the form of a game to... Is that economics? Why is that, do you think?
I think that it's a safe place. It's an area in which people are feel like they can make grand leaps and not be punished for it. I think it is economics to a certain extent. I have always felt that game design was given a bit short shrift. From designers and from traditional interface designers and from traditional graphic designers, in a variety of methods. You know, we have a variety of people digging into issues of narrative and how do we tell stories, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we have this place that's this game space, which if you look at it on the surface can seem very silly or very juvenile, but at its very core, there's a lot of very interesting things happening with. You know, where is interactive narrative? Well, it's probably already happened.
That's the area where they're actually only dealing with that because there's people that have to play.
Exactly.
It's a very direct connection between the designer and the user of it.
Exactly. And so I think that as designers, we haven't tapped it deeply enough. I think that in case of the Wii. The Wii, to me, is not so much a revolution in game design, but a revolution in hardware. What that does is that takes a variety of sort of pieces of equipment that would have been fairly expensive in the past, and for $30, we can connect that to any Macintosh, almost any PC, and immediately just have that data to work with. So it's just a radical simplification of what used to be something that was very hardware-oriented. So whereas 2 or 3 years ago, you know, you would need to have someone who was very good at programming and a strong sense of engineering of how to do all these sort of tricks. And today we're handed this sort of thing that's inexpensive and almost unbreakable. And students can start doing things to it. You know, I had a student recently who was tying them to balloons and floating them over the city, and you know, just they're
there goes the game.
Exactly, and they're chasing after it, trying to find it. Yeah, I think that's one area of interactive design that is in some ways perhaps unfettered by industry and unfettered by sort of historical precedent, and I think they've taken great advantage of it.
Yeah, that's also probably the reason there's much more going on. There's a little more in quantity, but also in speed. The development goes faster because there's probably also like the economic, how'd you say that?
Precedent.
Yeah, something like the economics that are necessary to sort of a feeding ground for these people to work with and make it easier to develop that.
I would say on top of that is something else that's very, very important.
Sorry, but the lack of history may be an advantage. That's what I'm trying to...
Yeah, oh, absolutely, absolutely. On top of that is also something that's very important, which is, I guess for lack of a better term, we'll call the Maker movement, okay? And what that is a variety of people around the world who are just really getting into this sort of do-it-yourself kind of... attitude. So it's not so much that Nintendo released a Wii. It's that a group of people on their own broke it down, tried to figure out how it works, and shared that with everyone over the internet so that other people could start building things with it. I think the processing movement, you know, and processing is this open source programming language for visual people, has all of a sudden, within the design world, has sort of brought this idea of people saying, well, I'm not a technical person, but I think I can do this. And so now all of a sudden they have this ability to start experimenting in this space. The Arduino board is similar. Here's a way of very quickly being able to prototype interfaces. People doing hardware hacking, taking currently existing pieces of equipment and taking them apart and turning them into something else. There's a huge movement of that taking place right now. And that's completely free, you know? And this shared network across the internet of people sort of seeing the experiments that they do. Johnny Cheung Lee is a great example of that, you know, who's someone who's doing very high-end work at Carnegie Mellon, dealing with things like projection tracking and stuff. All of his work is online. But, you know, he'll sort of do these fun experiments with the Wii and write a little piece of software and then put it out on the internet for people to start experimenting with. And then other people start taking that. And so within 1 or 2 weeks, I'll have someone in my class who says, oh, well, you know, this person who's a computer engineer has come up with this system, and they've given me all the tools that I need to now take that as a piece of interface and start applying it to a problem or a context. And that's really exciting. And that's not coming from Nintendo, and it's not coming from the game companies. It's coming from people taking those things and bending them and shifting them. You know, a similar thing is happening with these video game engines. I met somebody who was doing very interesting work taking one of these real-time 3D shooting games and using that as an engine to create inexpensive cave systems. And a cave system is a system in which you project on multiple walls at the same time to create immersive environments. So they were, instead of spending hundreds of thousands of dollars for hardware, they would take a couple of projectors and put them on stands and then take these game engines and just modify them so that they become sort of real-time, three-dimensional environments that people could do research. So a colleague of mine is now digitizing things like Mayan ruins so people can sort of go and experience them at a very inexpensive level. So there's this one level of sort of, you know, people developing interesting hardware, and then there's a second level of people, of everyday people, who are taking it, breaking things, finding new uses for things, in the traditional definition of the term hacking, and then providing those tools to everybody.
You think that open source is vital for that?
I would say almost everything that I showed today in my presentation comes down to the open source movement. So the Reactable, which I think is an amazing project, is a commercial product, but the core of that entire system is released open source. And they're using that in the MIT Media Lab, because why develop a better system or a different system when that works so well? And they're using it at my school, they're using it in a variety of places. All the work with the Wiimote, again, is entirely open source. And programming languages like processing. And in ways of using it, Adobe Flash also, the ability to make Flash movies is actually also open source. You don't need to own Adobe Flash to make those. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think open source right now is something that is the primary driver of this. And for students who are motivated, their realization is there's nothing holding them back now. So whereas before they would need expensive hardware, they would, you know, everything is out there. It's on the internet, it's free, it's well documented. So for a student who is, you know, who is interested in these areas, all they need to do is do a little bit of learning, a little bit of reading, and they have those things at their hands.
It's a bit, you could say that I'm really stretching it, but it's a bit of a socialist idea, the whole open source.
Oh, I think absolutely.
And it's like maybe that's the solution coming from the open source community instead of coming from really commercialized economic like companies. It should say something about like the state of the world what we're in.
Well, if it's all about sharing now, I mean, it's not I'm first and I'm, you're not hiding what you're doing. Because I think people realize more and more you need somebody else to go forward with what you're making.
Well, in my opinion, I mean, I think that's something really wonderful about something like the Reactable, you know, that table. The technology to work with it, they've open sourced. What's really their own property is that beautiful interface and the way that it works, and sort of that gesture language that they've developed for that. And in a way, like, people understand that that's what they have ownership of, and that's respected, mm-hmm. You know? So, you know, if you have that creative idea, then it doesn't hurt you at all to share the rest of those pieces to others. You know, I always felt this way very much about typeface design. You know, and that I really wanted people to be able to use my typefaces. And in that way, you know, as soon as I realized that there wasn't an economic model to make money from them, I would almost rather make them for free because I'd rather people be able to use them, you know, as creating tools for designers. And I think today we see a wide variety of people who are doing the same thing. You know, we're creating tools for others. So how can we sort of build upon that and put it out to see what happens? And we all do it together. I think that that's an absolute key part of this movement. And I think that our design students are getting that because they understand that, you know, how well they use the technology may initially get them hired, but that's not really what their education is. You know, it's about their ideas. And that's something that people, you know, can't really steal. I mean, I feel the same way about curriculum. I've always felt fairly comfortable sharing the curriculum of the things I teach. And that's because early on I realized that I can't teach someone else's curriculum. And someone else, if they try to take my curriculum and teach it, you know, maybe they teach it in their own way, but they can't really take what I do and share it. I mean, that comes from my own personal experience. So in that way, there's no harm in me taking what I do and sharing it with others. And I think people are doing that on the hardware front, and they're doing it in a wide variety of places. It boils down to the core of what we do in terms of a creative activity. I mean, that's something that, you know, can be shared, but it can't really be stolen. I mean, it can in traditional plagiaristic ways, but you know. And I think that's actually worked quite well. And we're seeing it in the music industry as well, you know.
Could you say, I'm stretching even more, could you say this is a number of things, a very visible victory for the open source community, which is a bit of a socialist idea, the recession, capitalism that has been expanded up to the point that it sort of broke, which is happening now. Could you say that, like, this is the victory over capitalism?
I don't know. I mean, it's not something I've thought very deeply about. But in many ways, the open source community has always benefited from strong support. And without that support, you know, I'd be curious to see what happens, you know. So I don't see it as one over the other, because I think it can only go so far. I think it's like any volunteer opportunity. As it gets larger and larger and larger, it starts putting more and more demands on others. And we're in a very interesting age where there's a whole group of people that sort of, as their hobby, I mean, similar to what I was saying earlier, you know, will sit down and program things for fun. And that's what these open source systems are based upon, you know, of people who do this as a lifestyle. I'm not sure that can sustain itself forever. Mm. And I think that there is always going to need to be some sort of level of support. And I think that it's also not for everybody. You know, one of the key things for our students is learning to become self-starters. To succeed in the open source movement, you need to be able to be a self-learner, and you need to have a level of independence, because no one's going to hand it to you, because that's nobody's job. The idea is the information is out there, and you go and you find what you need, and you bring it together. And not everyone is capable of that, you know. So, you know, would we want open source design tools? Who knows? You know, do we need them? I'm not sure. Mm. On the other hand, you know, I've actually been pleasantly surprised at some of the things that Adobe has done to the open source movement, in terms of developing tools and developing structures for those of us who are within this movement. And I think we've benefited from that support. So I don't necessarily see them as being antagonistic. Mm. I see them as sort of working side by side. In many ways, the open source area can be a place where experimentation can take place that couldn't take place in a pure commercial world. Mm. But as those ideas become more and more congealed, they can then be brought over and moved in.
For example, in your presentation, you showed the development of that tool.
The Photoshop toolbar.
Well, yeah, and I was actually surprised how little it has changed.
It's changed very little. It's changed very little.
I was looking from one to the other, and at some point, it's almost a scale difference. There is no...
Yeah.
It's exactly the same tool.
It's only two or three little icons that changed.
There was a wonderful lecture by Ellen Lupton where she talks about sort of the new Bauhaus. And she says, you know, who are the people who are really thinking about the fundamentals of visual language? And she actually said, it's not really design students anymore. They're learning something else. The people who are really thinking about these kinds of core language issues are like the people who create the menus in Photoshop. And I think that's a really sort of funny idea. I have found within that development that there's growing abstraction. And I find that a lot of designers, particularly designers who are not working in the interactive areas, are finding programs like this becoming more and more confusing. So there's always been a bit of a play. So we have something like the paint bucket tool, but then we have the Bezier pen, like an Illustrator. And of course, the Bezier pen cannot exist in real life. You're drawing with mathematics, you know. But people have generally gotten that. They kind of gave it this metaphor of a pen, and people followed along. But then we move into things like newer features like smart layers and things like that in Photoshop. And I find that a lot of people are like, well, you know, or like the vector tools in Photoshop. And well, why would we want this? And what's appropriate for this? And these ideas are becoming more and more abstract because of the way Photoshop is being used. These are essentially tools for interface designers, people who use Photoshop for layout as opposed to edit images. So in the breadth of it, there's a level of complexity that's getting added in, and the tools can no longer reflect that. So this wonderful one-to-one relationship that existed for so long, some of our tools are no longer tools that could ever exist in the real world anymore. And so there's going to need to be more and more abstraction as we go. And I'm kind of curious to see how they're going to handle that. But you're right. I mean, the core tools have always been there, and that's from like things like Mac Paint, you know. But this idea of direct manipulation, I think, is quite an interesting one. Mm. And it's an interface philosophy that deals with this idea of, you know, multiple quick changes to objects and visual feedback in doing that. So it's as if you're manipulating it in the real world. So our traditional Photoshop or InDesign box with the four corners and the dots is a great example of like a particular philosophy of interface. You know, okay, I can change it and I can see how I've changed it. I can make decisions and I can change it back. And then I can make decisions about it and I can change it back. And it's sort of one way of looking at how to make something feel as if it's a tangible object, when in reality it's really just a collection of dots.
If you grew up using the mouse and knowing how to use that, then I think then it's a different way of looking. If you're, it becomes tangible.
Well, for example, yeah. Most of my students probably don't know what the cropping tools are. Like, I've never used cropping squares.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we deal with this in icon design all the time, you know. If I say, draw a telephone, you know, and our students will draw sort of the traditional iconic view of a handset with some sort of a triangular body with buttons on the front, you know. And then, okay, well, but phones don't look like that anymore. They probably haven't looked like that for 6 or 7 years. And my daughter, who's 6, wouldn't recognize that as a telephone. That's not what telephones look like. So how do we even represent telephones? Maybe it should be more about what it does as opposed to what
it's
it like looks
like. It's like the trash can.
The recycling bin. Absolutely, absolutely. And there's a whole variety of these, of just sort of metaphors that are sort of stuck, but they're not really appropriate anymore. I remember a very telling experience for me when I was a student. Was we were asked by a professor to draw icons for fruit. And we had to draw watermelon. And when we got the results back, we were all very confused because we couldn't recognize the watermelons that people had drawn, because half the students were from Asia and had drawn round watermelons, and half the students were from America, and they had drawn oblong watermelons. And we were sort of confused. The same problem with a mailbox, you know. We have this icon of the traditional, you know, United States Western mailbox with the thing with the little flag, you know. But, I mean, how many people really have mailboxes like that?
For example, email, there's a symbol of a letter on it. There's a little envelope.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, these are, I don't know, this metaphorical relationship to things, I think, will cause us trouble down the road. We'll have to see.
If you had a chance to do something else than what you're doing right now, what would that be?
Film editor.
Film editor.
I'm, I'm, I, I've been able to do a little bit of it, not professionally, but certainly now everybody does a little bit of film editing. But I've always been fascinated at the construction of meaning through film language. I think that if I was, you know, going to start over again, it would probably be to go and actually get a fundamental education in.
How would you like to be remembered?
How would I like to be remembered? I think, certainly in terms of my students, I think I'd like to be remembered as someone who was very accessible. Someone who was able to sort of work with them, sort of not in a, you know, a sort of master and apprentice model, but as just someone who was able to sort of join them on the journey of interesting design research, was sort of there for them on that process. I think that's all a professor really can ask to do anymore. I think that's probably it.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Type Radio.